Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Maybe I don't have such a strong view that this person is an idiot, in fact, since I can't really explain what it is that they want to do.
Stats. What we need is stats. If Dickens' hard-nosed utilitarian Thomas Gradgrind were about today, he'd surely be knee-deep in Sage announcements and ONS data bulletins, trying to work out what the heck is going on with this virus. In the absence of a fictional Victorian schoolmaster, who better to lead us through the numerical mire than Tim Harford, economist, author, broadcaster and TED talker, whose new book, How to Make the World Add Up, is the perfect guide to seeing through the statistical fog. It's far more than just a handy spark notes for numeracy, though, as Tim delves into the deeply held psychological biases that can steer us in the wrong direction and urges us to examine our emotional response before we hit share or retweet. I've been a fan of Tim's books and columns for some time, so it was a total pleasure to interview him about a book packed with insights and wonderful nuggets. Like, what do the inner workings of a toilet tell us about political polarisation? And the answer isn't as obvious as you might think.
There's quite a lot of books about statistics. I mean, I think of, for example, The Tiger That Isn't, which was by Andrew Dilnot, or John Alan Paulos's Innumeracy. But I think where your book's a little bit different is it's not just about kind of the maths or the data of it, but the way of the importance of controlling our emotions as well when we look at data.
That's absolutely right. It really struck me, particularly during the Brexit referendum and the US presidential election of 2016, I found myself with a team from More or Less on Radio 4 trying to give people the facts to understand the issues, to explain what was going on. And of course, it became clear that quite a lot of people on all sides were not that interested in the facts. They had particular views of the world that were shaped by their ideology, their preconceptions, their values, what their friends thought, none of which I think is shameful. And they reasoned accordingly. And most of the factual information that you might provide was basically just treated as ammunition for an argument. Like, does this back up what I already wanted to believe or not? And I realized, okay, those are extreme examples, but it's often true that what we believe is shaped by what we expect to believe, what we want to believe. And I thought, well, there's no point in writing a book that purely furnishes people with technical advice as to how not to make mathematical mistakes or statistical mistakes. I'm not also going to offer my perspective on how to think more clearly and not just be carried away by our own motivated reasoning. So that's what I wanted to do with the book.
Yeah, I mean, you set out the book in 10 rules, a kind of 10 commandments, if you like, but your golden rule that you say at the end is be curious. And I thought reading the book, perhaps another kind of way of expressing that is you're saying kind of tame your intuition. So you don't say that you should ignore your emotional reactions to things, but you should know which way they're pointing you, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, the first rule is to notice your emotions, not ignore your emotions or suppress your emotions, but to notice them. I think if you notice that a particular statistical claim that you're being confronted with is provoking a strong reaction of denial or vindication, or wait, you know, that can't be true, or wait till I share this with everyone on social media, it proves I was right all along. If that is your reaction, I think you're going to think a lot more clearly about the world and about the claim that's been made if you pause to notice that. So that I think is really important. As far as our intuitions are concerned, there's another chapter about what to do when statistics conflict with personal experience. I mean, to borrow terminology from Daniel Kahneman, there's a statistics fast and slow, right? So you go to a place, you meet people, you see things, you've got this incredibly rich, detailed, visceral view of what's going on. You can also understand the world by looking at spreadsheets. And I'm not making the argument that you might expect from a geek that the spreadsheets are inevitably superior, but neither are they inevitably inferior. So there's a real challenge and I think an opportunity to figure out how to get the best out of both, to combine that personal experience with the rather thinner, but potentially less biased and more comprehensive view that you gain from the spreadsheet, you gain from the data.
Yeah, and the example you give in the book is that going on a London tube or a bus, where the stats will tell you that the average train has only 100, 130 odd people on it, but you know when you get on it, there's 10 times that. But it's only through your personal experience that you realise there's more to that original kind of set of data.
Yes, I mean, that particular example I love because it's so it's such an elegant statistical point that's going on there. So to imagine what's happening, if you imagine 10 trains, one of them's got 1,000 people on and the other nine have zero people on, just the driver. So what's the average occupancy of the trains? Well, it's 100. Okay. What is the typical experience of a person riding on the train? Well, every single person riding on the train rode on a crowded train because there was nobody on the trains that didn't have any people on. And that's how you can get these statistics that suggest that the London bus network and the London Underground network are actually rather sparsely occupied. And at the same time, every time, obviously not in the time of coronavirus, but pre-coronavirus, every time you get on a train, it's packed. And again, not to say the statistics are wrong, because if you're running Transport for London, you want to know the utilization of the system. You want to know the energy per passenger, the carbon dioxide emissions per passenger. These things are important, but you also want to know what experience the passengers are actually having. So this is a really interesting example of trying to combine information that seems to conflict, but actually is they're two sides to the same coin, and they make perfect sense when you think about them in the right way.
And I think it's a point we'll come on to later with COVID, which is an absolute treasure trove of statistics and data. But I mean, it gets to the point about what you're counting being just as important. And it's often something we don't really think about when we look at a claim and think, well, is that actually the worthwhile metric that we want to be looking at?
Yeah, the experience of the average passenger is not the same thing as the experience of the average train. You would think they basically get at the same thing, but they don't get at the same thing at all. And very often we think we know what's being measured and we leap to conclusions accordingly. And we don't know what's being measured at all. A nice example is there's a whole literature on video games and do video games lead to violence? Do violent video games lead to violent behavior? And a lot of people have views about this based on their preconception, like they obviously do or they obviously don't. But actually, when you think about it, you realize, I don't really know what you mean by a violent video game. I mean, Pac-Man? Pac-Man eats people alive. Well, I mean, not alive, they're ghosts. But, you know, that's pretty fierce, but that's probably not what people have in mind when they say violent video game. But what do people, when these researchers are studying this, well, what do they mean by violent video game? And until you know that, you don't know much. And then what do you mean by play? Do you mean we got people in the lab for an hour and got them to play for an hour? Or do you mean we found somebody who plays these games a lot in reality? And then what do you mean by violent behavior? Do you mean we have evidence of real world offenses, grievous bodily harm, getting into fights? Or is it more there's some test that we give in the laboratory that gives us some correlation to violent behavior? And there's this thing called the hot sauce paradigm, which which measures your willingness to add chili sauce to a drink that you know someone else is going to drink. And I don't mean to sort of say, well, and one way of doing this is obviously nonsense and another way is obviously correct. I'm just saying, if you don't know this stuff, but you're immediately leaping to an opinion about video games and violence and what the research shows. Well, you're not only are you forming your opinions based on no real knowledge whatsoever, but also this stuff's really interesting and shouldn't you show an interest? Because actually what these scientists are doing and what they're finding is the kind of stuff that we should be interested in.
I mean, just from a personal point of view, how long do you think did it take you personally to kind of inculcate these mental habits? And when you see a jazzy graph, do you still have that visceral reaction where you go, ooh, or is it, what's that x-axis playing at?
Yeah. Well, I still have a visceral reaction, but I notice it. So I think I am less prone to just casually retweet. But I mean, certainly it's taken time. I certainly remember tweeting stuff. So within the age of Twitter, within the last sort of 12 years or so, and then being sort of embarrassed by my own behavior. So one example was, I remember seeing a graph, which I think was from the Washington Post. It was from a reasonable source showing dramatically increasing support for same-sex marriage. And I've got strong views about this. I think that's definitely a good thing. And I saw this graph and I was like, great. More and more people are on the right side of history. And I just retweeted it. Spread the good news. And the first reply to the tweet was, Tim, have you looked at the axes on that graph? And my heart just sank. Oh, God, what have I done? Because, of course, I hadn't. It was that emotional reaction of like, oh, this is good. I'm going to share. And the axes were a complete mess. I should have clipped the graph for my bad data visualization file rather than just amplifying it. But there you go. I'm sure I still make those mistakes, but hopefully I make them a little bit less often. It probably makes my Twitter feed a little bit less interesting.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I really liked the chapter about visualization, actually. I think that was one of the ones that really made me think about the way that you can present graphs. For example, there's one where you present the deaths in the Iraq war, one where it goes up and one where it goes down with red. And I found that kind of fascinating.
It's so the first graph is titled Iraq's Bloody Toll, and it's by, if I remember rightly, by Simon Scar, and won an award. And it's a very powerful graph, and it shows the death toll in Iraq. It's a bar graph in red, and the bars are hanging down from a line at the top of the graph. So it's as though someone just gashed across the paper and the blood just oozed down over the paper. And you look at it, you just go, oh, terrible, the tragedy there, the loss, the waste. And then a guy I know a little bit called Andy Cotgreave, who's a data visualization expert, just as a sort of demonstration of the emotional power of this graph, literally flipped it over. It just sort of took, I think, Microsoft Paint or something and just turned the graph upside down and then painted it a very cool, kind of soothing corporate grey, sort of bluish grey, kind of thing you can imagine a corporate logo, like an IBM logo or something. And he just relabeled it Iraq death toll on the decrease. And so he just robbed the graph of all its emotional power and described what it was showing, which was the deaths there used to be a lot of deaths and now there are not so many deaths. And both of those graphs are perfectly valid. I think both those graphs are telling the truth about the world. But it's just a reminder that the way you package a graph, the way you package exactly the same information can have a very, very different emotional impact. And this wasn't even a complicated transformation of the graph. It was absolutely the same information, crystal clear, but just with a different emotional temperature.
Yeah, I was also fascinated to learn about Florence Nightingale's contribution to this field, because I had no idea that she was... I'm slightly ashamed, actually, when I read it.
She is amazing.
She was a statistician.
So she was friends with all these sort of great mid-19th century figures, such as Quetelet and Babbage. And she moved in those circles, of course. There were some limitations on what she could do because of the fact that she was a woman, but she was also very high-born and very well-connected. She was the first woman to be a member of the Royal Statistical Society, and famously, of course, served as a nurse in Istanbul, dealing with British Army casualties coming back from the Crimean War. But after that experience, she formed a hypothesis about the importance of sanitation and hygiene in preventing disease, and then had to make that case to a skeptical military and medical establishment. So the chapter is partly about her efforts and the efforts of her collaborator, William Farr, to use data visualization to make their case, to make their arguments. She was very calculating about the way she did this. I mean, she was absolutely on the right side of history. But at the same time, some of the graphs she used, they're a bit naughty. They're a bit clever in the way they present information. So we'll try and pick them apart and show what she's done and how else you might have drawn that graph and how differently the information looks, even though it's got the same data there. So yeah, absolutely fascinating character.
And it's also quite a nice illustration of the way that a sort of a story gets told about a person. In Florence Nightingale's case, that, you know, she was a nurse is how people kind of know her, but actually the realities are a lot more complicated. Now, I mean, the medical...
I think, a lot better statistician than she was a nurse.
Right, exactly. And a very good data visualizer as well. As you point out, the Rose diagram is a real kind of a really artful way of presenting those statistics. But I mean, obviously, with the pandemic, you started writing, or you were still writing the book rather, in sort of March, February of this year. So it was just at the beginning. I mean, do you, when you look at the way that COVID's been covered, you know, what are the kind of key questions do you think the kind of layman would consider when being slightly sort of pummeled by data?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing to say is that the book was nearly finished when we went into lockdown. And I then asked my publisher for an extra month to revise it in the light of COVID, because COVID was really underlining the point that I was trying to make, which is that this is not just a question of statistics, are not just about political communication and spin. They're not just about selling stuff or about winning arguments. They are a very important tool for understanding what's going on in the world. And of course, when the virus hit, it was the most amazing example. I mean, it's a hell of a way to be proved right. It wasn't a lot of fun being proved right in this way, because it's been such a traumatic experience for everybody. But it was a very simple exercise to go through the book and to go, and coronavirus is a good example of this point, and coronavirus is a good example of that point. And just, you could point to very specific, very fresh examples. So to come back to your question about, well, what should the average person be doing to make sense of the COVID data? So, okay, number one, I'd be immediately suspicious of anybody who's trying to argue something. Someone who's trying to explain what's going on and help you understand, that's the kind of person I would be looking for. When you've got people who are really trying hard to make a particular case for a particular policy response, you're unlikely to get the full picture. You're unlikely to get a fair picture. And in some cases, you may get a very dishonest picture, although some people have been worse than others in that regard. So first of all, just try and look for someone who's just trying to explain what's going on. Like, here are the graphs, here's what they mean, here are the flaws in that data, here's another way to look at the problem. Second thing I would say is there is more than one way to see the problem. So for example, in the UK, you can look at cases in terms of the official case count. But we've seen recently how flawed that can be. The newspapers love it, the TV loves it, because you get new data every day, but the data are really, really noisy and biased in a number of ways, because they're the output of our testing system, and our testing system is not perfect. But you could also look at cases as, yeah, I mean, that's maybe putting it mildly, but you could look at cases as modeled by the Office for National Statistics. They come out every week, there's a delay, there are margins of error, but hopefully a much less noisy view of what's going on. You can also look at hospitalizations, what's happening to hospitalizations. And of course, you can look at death. And there's no one answer to understand how the virus is spreading. There are different things. If someone's trying to make an argument, they'll pick a particular data set or a particular data point that makes their argument. But if someone's trying to understand what's going on, you would expect to have to look at more than one source of data and to try and go, well, what does this collage of evidence tell us about what's going on? And what questions and what puzzles does it throw up? Which is all about, you highlighted this virtue of curiosity. I think it's really important. The world's a really interesting place. It's not always a simple place. And so actually wanting to know more and being willing to go deeper and to get a second opinion and to go another click is really going to help. And we can all be curious. That doesn't require any technical skills. That's a habit of mind and requires a bit of patience and a bit of interest in the world.
Yeah, it's something that struck me when reading the book is, as well as you talk about people having different views or prejudices, but often people have different objectives as well, and that can colour the way that you see. So like when we come back to Brexit, you might say that some people are ignoring facts like, oh, the economy is going to get worse. But for a lot of voters, they probably say, well, I don't care. That's not what it's about for me. Do you think that is that a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, no, we've all got different perspectives. We've all got different values. So the same with COVID. We all want to be able to go about our lives, you know, as we did, and gather together and party and go to music venues and go to restaurants. We also don't want to get sick, and we don't want our loved ones to get sick and die. And we don't want our health service to be overwhelmed by COVID cases. Well, it turns out we probably can't have all of these things at the same time. So then you have to start going, well, how do you trade off those different goods? The good of freedom, the good of people being able to develop their livelihoods, and the good of not getting sick and not dying, or children's education. I would hope that people would be able to present a balanced view of the evidence and to say, well, look, there's, these are the pros and cons. These are the choices in front of us. Unfortunately, these things get polarized very quickly. And, every time I write about the subject, I get angry emails from both sides deploring my, some people just deplore my centrism, full stop. other people just think I'm an extremist on whatever view they don't have. But there you go. You've got to try.
Yeah, I think it's the peril of having an opinion in the modern age is you're going to get bombarded. I mean, do you think there's anybody who has struck you as doing a particularly good job of elucidating the COVID data?
Yes, I mean, I would be remiss to not mention my colleagues at the Financial Times, led by John Byrne Murdoch, the coronavirus tracker at the FT, which is free for anyone to look at. I think it's been very good. And John's been fantastic on Twitter as well, really explaining the decisions he's made and why he's made them, and what you learn from them. Another great source is the Our World in Data website. And Johns Hopkins University has a great collation of data from around the world. And I would say actually the Office for National Statistics here in the UK has done a good job. They've got great data for England and Wales. They really rose to the challenge, and they're doing a huge survey now of the population. I think that in the last 2 weeks, 100,000 people have been tested purely for the purposes of trying to figure out where the virus is.
Just for the listeners, I'm holding up an ONS survey kit. In fact, they come every single week and test everyone in my household.
It's amazing. I'm right in thinking, am I, that they come and supervise you while you're doing it, right? They really...
Sometimes. I'm afraid to say, Tim, that it's been a bit of a shambles.
Oh, no, don't tell me that. I want to filter out that piece of information. Tell me about it.
Notice that they're coming.
Yeah.
And they'll ring me and be like, are you in tomorrow? I'm like, no. Okay, so we'll just meet your wife and daughter. So then they'll have to do a separate visit to come and see me. And it's all... slightly up in the air. But yeah, I mean, it's it's an incredible piece of work. And it's also just, it's done like by a postcode lottery, as far as I can tell.
Yes, they're trying. I mean, there are flaws in it. For example, the fact that, as I understand it, it doesn't include people in communal living arrangements. So care homes, prisons, okay, fine, no big deal. Oh, university halls of residence, not included. Could very rapidly become an issue in the quality of that data. But, you know, these things are hard. It's difficult to get really solid data, and we should, I think, not take it for granted and I recognize the flaws in what's happening, but also recognize the amazing efforts that are, you know, are required to help us understand the world around us.
That's something that has really come through. I mean, not just from my personal experience of having people driving around London trying to get my test and stuff, but from the book, when you talk about other countries, and as you say, we're very lucky to have the ONS, which produces an enormous range of statistics. If you go on their website, I mean, it's everything you can imagine is on there. But you mention in the book, for example, in, I think it's Tanzania, perhaps, or Uganda, where the chief statistician is threatened with death if they produce accurate statistics.
I didn't reveal which country. In fact, I don't know which country that was in.
I was told
that by Denise Leavesley, who's one of the pillars of the British statistical community, but also does a lot of work with statisticians from around the world. And she told me, yes, one African statistician who she did not name was told his children would be killed if he did not produce the results that was required. But I think Tanzania, it has been made against the law to criticize the government statistics. And in India, the unemployment statistics just kind of disappeared a few months before the election. You know, the government said, "Oh, we're doing some work to make these statistics more robust." They just vanished. And of course, there were these striking examples of the head of the Greek statistical agency being prosecuted for treason, and that case being thrown out and reinstated about six times. It was extraordinary. That's been going on 10 years. Or Argentina, Graciela Bevacqua, who was gathering inflation statistics and was told, that she had to round them down. Even if it was 2.9, that had to be rounded down to 2. If it was 1.9, that had to be rounded down to 1. It's as though Argentina had kind of run out of decimal points. I mean, this makes a huge difference to the, if that's monthly data, to the when you compound it up to the annual data. And she was eventually effectively forced to resign for not producing the correct results. And then when she did so in the private sector, she was fined $250,000 for false advertising. So, I mean, we're lucky to live in a country where statisticians, I'm sure they come under some political pressure, but it's nothing compared to what is experienced in some parts of the world. And I think it's a reminder of the importance of these statistics. We take them for granted. We kind of chuckle at them, and you know, we laugh when they go wrong, and we shrug about them. But if they, you know, if they really were so unimportant, dictators and autocrats wouldn't go to such extraordinary lengths to threaten or bully the people, the men and women who collect them. They do matter.
Yeah, I'm just briefly returning to the importance of statistics and COVID. I mean, do you think there's a silver lining that the public hopefully are a lot more interested in data and statistics now than they might have been 6 months ago? Or do you think that'll kind of wax and wane?
No, I think there is a silver lining. I mean, it's a pretty dark cloud, and it's a pretty slim silver lining. So I don't want to sort of be looking on the bright side too much. But yes, we have received a painful lesson that this stuff matters, that the numbers are the way that we understand the world, that we measure the spread of the virus, that we understand who's at risk most and who's not at risk, that we track the spread of things such as long COVID. They're the way that we evaluate treatments. Dexamethasone works, hydrochloroquine doesn't work. We know this because of the robust use of statistics. They're how we're going to test the vaccine and know that it's safe and know that it works. This stuff really matters. And to relegate statistics to just another branch of rhetoric, just another way that governments and advertisers spin stuff, I think would be tragic. And it's very easy to fall into that trap. I think even my fellow geeks, you're trying to explain statistics to somebody, and kind of the simplest and funniest way to do that is to talk about people getting it wrong and to go into that debunking mode. I think if that's all we do, we risk giving a very skewed view of of what these statistics really are and how useful they can be.
Do you think there's a risk too of statisticians or mathematicians kind of gatekeeping a bit and making it seem more complicated and impenetrable than it is to the general public?
It's always a risk. I think that, of course, it is complicated. Of course, there are many traps for the unwary. But I think that one of the arguments I want to make in the book is that fundamentally, the kinds of questions you need to ask to make sense of statistics, they're questions that anybody can ask. It's not that hard. We should all have a little bit of confidence in our own, I wouldn't say common sense, but our own guided common sense, or our own tutored common sense. A little bit of practical advice can get any of us a long way to asking the right questions and to making our world add up.
We started off the podcast talking about Brexit and, how facts were, a lot of people were sort of impervious to facts. But one of the things that I thought I really liked at the end of the book was that you point out a way that you can still get people to change their minds. Now, the way I'd phrase the question to you would be, can you tell us what the inner workings of a toilet tell us about political polarization?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't phrase it as trying to get people to change their minds. But I think there is a way to get people to be more interested in what's true and what's not true. And yes, where does the toilet come into it? So this is a wonderful study into a phenomenon called the illusion of explanatory depth. You say to somebody, how confident are you in your ability to understand how a zip fastener works? Or how would you rate your knowledge of how a bicycle works or how a flush lavatory works? And people will generally be fairly confident. They think, I sort of know how a zip fastener works. And then when you ask them to then explain in detail, give them a pen and paper, ask them to set out in bullet points and to draw diagrams, people very quickly realize that sense they had that they could explain in depth was an illusion, hence the phrase, the illusion of explanatory depth. And they back away from their previous confidence. And they say, actually, I don't really know. How does the water disappear around the U-bend? And how does it get replaced with clean water? I mean, how does that happen, actually? It's very interesting. But the same thing is true. You can do a similar exercise by talking to people about policy proposals. So we're starting to realize, the customs union and the single market, I thought they were the same thing, but it turns out they're not the same thing. I know that much, but do I really know more than that? So you get people, again, to rate their knowledge of, do you know what the single market is? Do you know how a cap and trade system works? Do you know what it means to impose unilateral sanctions on Iran? And people, again, will say, I basically know that. And then again, when you ask them to explain, they realize they don't. They don't have a clue, really, how one would go about imposing unilateral sanctions on Iran, or what exactly the difference is between the single market and the customs union. And what's interesting about that is not only do people recognize the limits of their own knowledge, but when they've gone through that exercise, they start to moderate their views. Oh, well, I thought this person was an idiot for suggesting that we leave the customs union. But now I realize I can't actually explain what the customs union is or how it differs from the single market. Maybe I don't have such a strong view that this person is an idiot, in fact, since I can't really explain what it is that they want to do. So people become more moderate. People become more respectful of people on the other side. They're more willing to accept shades of gray. And so that whole area of research, to me, suggests that we should be having more conversations where we ask each other to explain things, rather than to justify things. Because if we're having an argument about the single market and I ask you to explain what the single market is, then either you're going to learn something or I'm going to learn something, or maybe both of us are going to learn something. And the mere fact that we're not trying to persuade each other of anything, I think, is helpful.
Well, I think that's a really lovely note to end on. So ask yourself plenty of questions, but also ask other people questions and you might find out a bit more about the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.